One of the smartest young men in the conservative movement today, thinker, writer, senior editor, Conservative Review. I'm honored to be the editor-in-chief, where I've gotten to know Daniel Horowitz. Daniel Horowitz, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Honored to be on. Too bad I can't join you in the bunker tonight.
Well, you know, truthfully, nobody can. But that's okay. Anyway, you have a magnificent book. As you know, I looked at it before it came out and wrote the foreword to it, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Ladies and gentlemen, Amazon.com, any bookstore, on Mark Levin Show Facebook, Mark Levin Show Twitter. This is a must-read book, Stolen Sovereignty. Okay, generally speaking, what caused you to write this book, and what is the general mission of this book?
Sure. I realize that we are reaching a cathartic moment in our history where elections don't matter. The late Justice Scalia warned before his untimely demise, that we are facing something much worse than taxation without representation. We are facing what I refer to as stolen sovereignty. He called social transformation without representation, where all the major political and social issues of our time are being decided solely and with finality by the courts, the unelected branch of government. You've written on this for years. You wrote Men in Black about 11, 12 years ago. And since then, things have gotten so insane. I was inspired to write this book last year when the courts redefined the building block of all civilization, marriage, and then Kim Davis was thrown in jail on September 3rd of last year for merely being a Christian. On that same day, a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals panel invalidated the deportation of a criminal alien, asserting that that individual was transgendered, applied international law to say that the person can't be returned to Mexico, and then castigated the immigration officials for not using the proper pronoun. That's when I realized, Houston, we've got a problem here. We will not survive another few years as a republic, irrespective of who wins this election, if the courts are not stripped of their power. And I was just struck at the helplessness on our side, how everyone thinks there's nothing we can do, maybe short of amending the Constitution. Maybe we should appoint better judges, which, as I note in my book, is a fool's errand in the long run to solely focus on that. My goal is to say
Let me stop you before you go on. Let me stop you. You are arguing in the book, a position I strongly agree with, that the Constitution already provides a remedy. Now, what is that?
Exactly. Even to the extent one believes the courts have the power of the eminent tribunal, which, as you've argued for many years, they do not, there is always a remedy. Article 3, Section 2, I have an entire chapter laying out the case for Congress's plenary authority, absolute power, to exempt and regulate the jurisdiction of the courts. So the notion that the courts could say, you know what, a man is a woman now for purposes of state law. A marriage is not a marriage. You have to fund Planned Parenthood. You can't regulate abortion clinics. They do not have the power to do that if Congress protects the states and simply says, no, they do not have the power to adjudicate. You know, a lot of people say they're a separate but equal branch of government. That's true to a certain extent, but the Constitution disagrees with it to its fullest extent because they vested Congress with the authority to define the scope. So, Mark, not only could Congress strip them of their jurisdiction, John Marshall himself admitted that they don't have any jurisdiction other than what Congress affirmatively grants them.
Right. Other than a few areas that the Constitution spells out, Congress does have this power to limit the reach of the courts. Now, you and I aren't arguing that they ought to always step in and strip the courts of this and that. What we're saying is when you have an activist court like the Supreme Court is, and you have 30, 40 states that go one way and five justices decide they should go the other way, that's time for the Congress to step in.
What I am arguing is we have reached a point of no return way beyond what even you were arguing that 11, 12 years ago, Robert Bork, Ed Meese from a previous generation ago. They were not confronted with codifying transgenderism. Let me just say, since my book came out, the lower courts, which, by the way, I warn in the book, are even a bigger problem than the Supreme Court. Many cases are decided there. They don't make it to the Supreme Court. They have mandated funding for Planned Parenthood, destroyed religious liberty in Mississippi. They've codified transgenderism in a few cases. They've mandated states give birth certificates to illegal aliens. And they're tossing out basic voter integrity laws, voter ID. I mean, you talk about early voting now. Early voting didn't exist as a matter of policy in most states until a decade ago, yet the courts are now saying if you don't do it, it's against the Constitution or the voting or Civil Rights Act or something like that. How do we allow this to stand for even one day when we have the authority to simply say the courts do not have jurisdiction over this issue?
And yet you talk about this, and it's as if you're speaking a foreign language. Congress does not appear to have a desire to reassert its authority on behalf of its constituents, does it?
No, I mean, and this is a problem across the board. Obviously, Senator Lee was just mentioning this with the executive branch. We're seeing both the executive and judiciary branch are running roughshod over the people. This is the social transformation without representation that we're seeing. That in a Republican form of government, Madison always said the legislature necessarily predominates because they are the closest to the people. But if you look at all the major social transformations taking place, they're either pushed by executive agencies or the bureaucrats. And what I warn about in the book, and this is the name Stolen Sovereignty, that I believe we are reaching the final frontier of judicial tyranny, where for years they've been codifying special privileges for protected classes, flipping unalienable rights on its head for protected classes of Americans. They're now copying and pasting those rights to foreign nationals. So this manifests itself with birthright citizenship, illegal aliens counted in the census. You're seeing with voter integrity laws for states to even prevent illegal voters, non-citizens from voting. They are not only deciding every political and social question of our time that should be left to a legislature, they are preventing conservatives from even winning elections and having fair elections in the first place. This is why I see this problem as pretty much the most imminent constitutional crisis we have to confront at this moment.
Because, Daniel Horowitz, your excellent book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America, because there is a check, as you point out, in the Constitution, and that is a check on the courts going into these areas. And if Congress doesn't exercise that power, then there is no check.
It's unbelievable. And you know, the two of us have been dealing with this, I know, in the legal profession, even on the conservative side. Everything is no. I remember when your Liberty Amendments came out and you proposed using Article 5. Again, this is not something foreign. We're talking about pursuing constitutional remedies to combat unconstitutional coups throughout our government that the left has perpetrated for 100 years, and our side says no to everything. The only thing that's going to fail.
By the way, the Federalist Society, most of the lawyers at the Federalist Society said, no, we can't do that. And I'm going, well, aren't you originalists? What are you talking about?
Oh, I'm going to be persona non grata now. I mean, this is like a war on them because they feel that all you have to do is just appoint better judges. And I know a lot of people are saying Republicans must win this election because we need to win back the court or prevent the courts from going the wrong way. What my book is warning is that the courts are gone. It's the redefinition of marriage and now the redefinition of sexuality in many circuits and mandating early voting and fraudulent voting is not a wake-up call. Let me just say the D.C. Circuit is the second most important circuit. Democrats have an 11-1 majority on the district level, 7-4 majority on the circuit level, and not all the four Republican appointees are originalists. We are not going to win this back even if you had 10, 12 years of GOP governance. We need to do something now, and this notion that we're going to continue banging our head against the wall, just say appoint better judges, the system is so flawed. When we have this erroneous notion and we give into the premise that the courts are not just a co-equal branch to engage in judicial review, but they are above, they are the sole and final arbiter of every single important question of our time, we've lost our system of governance. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who wins the election. I guarantee you, pick your favorite policy while you want a Republican governor or president, that policy will be thrown out.
I've got 2 or 3 minutes. Daniel Horowitz, do you believe, that the framers of the Constitution in Philadelphia would have adopted a constitution, or the ratifiers in the states would have ratified a constitution that created a court system like the one we have today?
Well, I'm picturing going over to Madison, Hamilton, and telling them that a district court, a circuit court, which is created by Congress in the first place, would have the ability to tell a state that a guy with a yin and a yang must use the female bathroom. I mean, if that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what it is. You said this many years, that the Constitutional Congress explicitly rejected the notion of a council of revision. And even the council of revision was predicated on a different system of governance. It was predicated on using it in lieu of a presidential veto. You would have the president, a couple of other elected officials involved. Here, on top of a presidential veto, the notion that you could have an eminent tribunal that is completely unelected and there's nothing you can do about it, and they could redefine civilization issues, and we just accept it and say it's the law of the land, we should just give up. And this is the thing. This is more important than elections. If we don't stop the courts within the next few years, and we aren't going to stop it by merely appointing some better judges, we will no longer have individual state and national sovereignty.
I'm so fascinated by your book and this discussion. I'd like to hold you over. Are you available?
Absolutely.
All right. Don't hang up. Well, the great young men out there, conservatives, conservative thinkers and writers, Daniel Horowitz, Stolen Sovereignty. This is a terrific book, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. So Daniel Horowitz, and by the way, we have linked to it on Mark Levin Show Facebook and Mark Levin Show Twitter, and it's out there all over the place. What kind of a reception is your book getting?
You know, it's really an eye-opener. A lot of people actually thought the courts are the final arbiter of everything. That's what even conservatives are trained to think, and this is something that is so dangerous, because as you noted, there's got to be some sort of limit to it. And, you know, I don't just discuss the Supreme Court. The lower courts are destroying this country. Did you know that Obama has appointed 40% of the district bench, 33% of the appellate bench, and, you know, if you game out circuit by circuit, there's really only one or two where there's even a shred of sanity left. So, I mean, this is not going to go away anytime soon. It's not going to go away with 4 or 8 years of a Republican president. And, again, Congress, you know, whereas they only have power over the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, when it comes to the lower courts, they could make them, break them. They could make them sit with a dunce cap. They could,
explain everybody, these federal district and appellate courts, they're all creations of Congress.
Exactly. This notion that one district or circuit judge could redefine marriage, could throw out a congressional immigration statute, which they're starting to do a lot, even though, as I note in my book, Congress, there's 100 years of case law that Congress has full power over immigration. They don't have that power because Congress created them. Article 1, Article 3 calls upon Congress to exercise their prerogative to have inferior tribunals and create them. So the numbers, the geography, the jurisdiction, the way they operate, the administrative rules, they could regulate. They need to step in. This is the one variable we have never explored. It's always the courts are doing their thing and we have to suffer. No one ever looks to, well, maybe we ought to break up the courts. And again, with the Supreme Court outside of their original jurisdiction, which is kind of esoteric and is really only 3-4 things, doesn't affect most of these societal things, at least as it relates to issues pertaining to sovereignty, to immigration, religious liberty, Congress needs to reclaim the power for the people. To be clear, state courts could still deal with these cases like they used to. By the way, you know, the lower courts didn't even have power to look at the constitutionality of issues until 1875. They don't teach that in political science anymore. They didn't predate the Constitution. They didn't predate Congress. Congress created them.
And this is, you know, a critically important point that you're making, because you had this decision, the same-sex marriage decision as an example, which destroyed every other decision in every other state, whether by the people or even the state courts. And what's the answer from Lindsey Graham? Move along. Just move along. The court has decided. That's the end of that. And this is what we hear all the time. Move along. The courts have decided. Hell no, we don't want to move along. And the other thing is the left, they don't even honor the Constitution. You and I, we talk about, look, there's recourse in the Constitution. And suddenly we're radicals, Meanwhile, they keep rewriting the Constitution without the benefit of going through the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, a number of them are saying this is the law of the land, the courts have already decided. And if the courts could decide, if they could redefine the building block of all civilization, and as we speak, I mean, the Fourth Circuit has already codified transgenderism into civil rights and pretty much the 14th Amendment as well. The point is, if they could do that, what can the courts not do? Even King George didn't do this. We would have never started a revolution. The states would have never joined in the Federal Union had they been told they could do this.
And well, David Horowitz, I just want to mention the book again before we go. Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Get it. I strongly encourage you. Check it out. It's on my social sites, any major bookstore, and Amazon. God bless you, my friend. We salute all you heroes out there, and I'll see you tomorrow on the radio.
So he is Daniel Horowitz, senior editor at Conservative Review, and his new book is Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. And that, Mr. Horowitz, is quite a mouthful. That's a pretty gutsy book to write. Welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Really appreciate being on, and a longtime student of Prager University.
Well, I didn't know that, and I'm very touched and happy to hear it. Now, I guess I should just go right into it. Is it even possible to stop unelected judges from transforming America? What can be done?
Article 3, Section 2 provides Congress with the plenary authority to regulate and exempt the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. And then let's just start with the lower courts. The lower courts are created by Congress. So the notion that a district judge, let's just say, could say, you know what, a marriage must be recognized for five individuals, or a man is really a woman for purposes of state, you know, laws, or voter ID is unconstitutional. The notion that Congress could has to sit back and, man, there's nothing we could do but amend the Constitution. No, they are illegally amending the Constitution. Congress, I actually note in my book, and even John Marshall agreed to this, Congress had to affirmatively grant the courts jurisdiction in the Judiciary Act of 1789 in order for them to adjudicate these cases. Had they not done that, they would not have the power. In a democracy, as Madison said, a republic, I'm sorry, the legislature necessarily predominates. And as much as we don't like Congress, at least we have recourse, and the people's representatives have to take back control.
All right, I like that. Okay, so Congress declares war on judicial overreach. Okay, how does it do it? Does it abolish lower courts? What does it do?
There's a number of things they can do. So they could start with broad social and political issues that the courts have never had power over. So in my book, I deal a lot with, and this is the sovereignty, immigration. There's a growing trend where the courts are violating 150 years of settled case law that Congress has full authority over sovereignty, and they're granting rights and privileges to illegals. They're invalidating deportations of criminal aliens. This is a growing problem. A lot of people are focused on executive amnesty. We're going to have judicial amnesty if you have a Republican president, because the courts are just going to do it. So Congress needs to, you pass a law, for example, you say, we're defining citizenship like this or immigration enforcement like this, and the courts do not have jurisdiction to adjudicate cases overturning this law, period.
Well, why doesn't it just say that law is unconstitutional?
Why doesn't Congress say that?
No, why don't the courts? You say the Congress passes laws with regard to citizenship or deportation, then the court, though, says, excuse me, but that's not constitutional. And then the congressional law, is then overthrown.
Well, this is the intellectual firepower I seek to give in this book, is that at some point, Congress has to take it back. At some point, you have to say no. The courts don't have that authority. And I'm not just saying here just to say no, even though they don't have the authority. Congress has plenary power to define their jurisdiction. There's case law on this. Now, you know,
all right.
Academic disputes over, can you get rid of
all
everything?
All right, this is, folks, why you have to read the book. And I mean it. This is very important, what you've done. All right, I thank you, Daniel Horowitz. The book is Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. We will need a war between Congress and courts. He's right.
Welcome, everyone, to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice, broadcasting from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. Today, we're pleased and honored to have as our guest Daniel Horowitz. He's a senior editor at Conservative Review, focusing on hot-button issues in Congress. And boy, there's got to be a truckload of hot-button issues these days in Congress. Mr. Horowitz has a unique way of providing in-depth analysis of political happenings in D.C., grounding in true conservative principle, which is going to be one of the subjects of our conversation today. He is a contributing editor at redstate.com, as a contributor on The Blaze, by the way, a program I truly enjoy watching, and Breitbart, and is working in tax and immigration policy in Washington. Currently, he is regarded as one of the foremost conservative experts on immigration policy. My favorite subject, by the way. Daniel is also a regular guest on nationally syndicated radio programs, along with weekly appearances on over 100 regional radio programs. And now he's reached the pinnacle of his success. He's on Liberty Talk Radio. He is the author also of the upcoming book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel, welcome to our program.
Hey, great to be with you. I love that New York accent.
I'm a street kid from New York, you know, so you're going to have to excuse me because I got maybe some street smarts, but not much else, okay? So I beg your forgiveness in advance.
To illustrate the absurdity that the entire country hangs in the balance for what the unelected tribunal does, let me give you an anecdote from history. John Jay sat on the first Supreme Court, the original Supreme Court. And it's very important to glean. You could learn a lot from the first Congress, the first session of Supreme Court, because these were packed with people that both sat on the Constitutional Congress, were founding fathers, and then, you know, were the first members of the actual operating government. So you see kind of the way at least it was envisioned for the most part. And, you know, he retired and he got involved in politics, was Secretary of State, was in the George Washington administration. And then John Adams asked him to come back and serve on the Supreme Court. He wanted to appoint him. And he wrote a letter, and he basically said, the courts suck. And he didn't use that word, but he said, what a miserable place, and it's the most boring thing, and they have no power. And the point is, it just you read it, and you're like, that's the point. And you know, he became a politician. He was Secretary of State. He wanted to influence public policy. So you get involved in the executive or legislative branches. Here you see their job was to adjudicate bankruptcy disputes and, you know, litigate. That their job wasn't to mold national policy. What I call in my book, what's taking place, social transformation without representation, which is worse than taxation without representation. They're changing the character of the country, and they have more power. They don't really have it, but they've stolen it from the legislature. So you're absolutely right that we're sitting here and saying, oh my gosh, who are we going to appoint on the court? And then we're all like, well, I want this guy, I want that guy. We should all step back, and this is what my book is all about. The fact that we're raising the specter of how important it is should awaken people to how we've hit rock bottom, right, in our post-constitutional society. They don't have such power. It doesn't make sense that elections will hinge on electing people so they can elect people, right? You elect the legislature. You know, it's interesting. One of the systems of governance that Madison actually liked it, that he was floating, was the Council of Revision, where the Congress would go and pass a law. And then instead of our system, you have a presidential veto, you would have the president, some members of the Supreme Court, and maybe some other people, maybe some congressional leadership, get together and have a council of revision and take a look at it and judge the constitutionality of it. So, but it was rejected. There is no council of revision. We didn't adopt that system. But even that system, it was predicated on two things. It was, one, without a presidential veto, and number two, it involved some degree of elected officials. It wasn't just the courts. What we have now is you pass a law. You have a presidential veto power. Now you have a judicial veto power that's solely in the hands of people who are unelected for lifetime appointments. Yeah. It is clear the founders never, ever envisioned that. I think people allowed it to go on for a little while. Like I said, they wanted finality, uniformity. It started to a large degree when Democrats dominated Congress. So they didn't care about ceding the authority because they liked the outcomes. You know, and this is the intellectual dishonesty. They liked the political outcomes, even though it didn't follow the law and the Constitution. And then it's just been growing and growing and growing to the point where we can now have a court tell North Carolina, all right, a guy with a penis is a woman.
Yeah.
You know, a state has the authority to maintain gender integrity in private gender spaces as they have been since the dawn of civilization. To the extent someone, for whatever reason, wants to change that, you got to do it in the legislature. I mean, you can't have such radical transformations being dictated by the courts. A state says you need to submit a photo ID to vote. I mean, I go out and purchase Sudafed a lot for my congestion, and I need to show photo ID to do anything you do. So to protect the franchise, and I have a lot of information on this in chapter 8 of my book about non-citizens voting. There is no greater disenfranchisement of the people, greater violation of the social contract, the social compact, popular sovereignty, governance by the consent of the governed, than by illegally having people that are not members to that society and haven't been admitted, diluting that vote. We have a very big problem with fraudulent voting. I go into details how it has determined some very close elections, which in turn determine the outcome of bills like Obamacare. This is a very bad thing, and states are trying to clamp down on it. Early voting, it's insane. I mean, to have a voting month instead of a voting day, that is, I prove that is manifestly against the spirit of the Constitution. They designed it that you'd have one uniform day where you render your decision, seeing the same election and everyone seeing the same things, not voting at different times. And yet states cannot even clamp down on that because courts say, I'm not kidding. The Fourth Circuit said almost explicitly, any method or procedure of elections that Democrats come up with that will show that it will boost black turnout is therefore a legal mandate that you now have to adopt it. So let's say they say that, okay, your polls close at 8 p.m. at night. That's when they usually 7, 8 p.m. You know what? And I'm making this up. I'm just saying more blacks or more, you know, whatever, you know, group of people tend to turn out late at night. Boom. You got to have polls open until 11 p.m. Congress could say that pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, anyway, that states have full power over the methods and procedures of elections. But to the extent that the courts have violated that, the courts do not have jurisdiction to overturn state laws doing this, state laws governing election methods. And by the way, just to show you how absurd this is, people, revisionist history, people think the Constitution mandates the court's power and they have it. The Congress didn't even give the lower courts the ability to decide constitutionality of case until 1875. The Supreme Court didn't have the ability to overturn all cases of state Supreme Courts until 1914. So it's not just, to be clear, and I want to be, this is very important, it's not just that Congress has the ability to strip their jurisdiction. It's that they don't affirmatively have any jurisdiction other than what Congress vests them with. Implicit in the 1789 Judiciary Act that created the entire judiciary branch of government, created it, is the fact that, and John Marshall, who was the judicial strongman of his day and the guy who started the Judicial Review, he agreed that Congress in 1789, they were exercising that power and what is not given in there. They do not have standing power to decide, period. And a lot of people are going to throw at me, well, Daniel, what happened to the separate but equal branches? Well, you know, nothing is absolute everyone knows it's not equal. The legislature is not equal to the judiciary, and in several cases. Article 3 is very short and very vague. There is almost no debate, according to the Max Ferrand, the big expert on the constitutional Congress debates on Article 3. It wasn't much controversy. It's very simple, like you said at the beginning of this broadcast, the judges in court, interpreting the law. Congress had to create them. Now, they had a mandate to create some sort of Supreme Court that had a very limited and esoteric original jurisdiction, and they had the optional prerogative to create subdivisions. Now, states have their own constitutions, their own court systems. They predated the Constitution. They could do what they want pursuant to their constitutions. But you can't tell me it's separate because Congress had to create this. Do you know that this notion that you have to have 9 Supreme Court justices? The original Supreme Court, Congress only gave them 6. Another thing I explore in the book, who says that 5-4 is binding? Who made that up? The proof to that is the court started off 6 people. So by definition, to get a majority, you needed 4-2. That's 67%, right? So, and by the way, it also shows you that they weren't important and they weren't the final arbiter, the fact that they didn't make an odd number. I mean, that's just a side point. But this is a discussion that it's lost on every law school in America, maybe except for Hillsdale or whatever. It's lost on civics. Getting back to our discussion, what's a liberal and what's a conservative? It doesn't even matter.
Right. Yeah.
The courts decide everything, and they don't have that power. This is not the system of governance we adopted. The states would have never agreed to ratify the Constitution had they known. They would have been, every little basic power they have would be thrown out by the courts, whether you agree with them as a matter of policy or not. They have the power to enact these laws, and it is simply astounding. So one of the things, aside for jurisdiction stripping, which people get all out of whack, and I'm going to be a pariah with the conservative legal circles for saying that, because they, as much as they complain about it, they respect the broken system.
Has Congress ever overturned a ruling by the Supreme Court?
So I want to be careful with the language. There is ex post facto. There's a very important, unalienable kind of fundamental right from common law, basic law. You can overturn a judgment to a specific plaintiff that happened. But the point is that is binding precedent as national policy. So, for example, why is abortion so contentious in this country? The reason is because in other countries it's decided, well, when does life begin? That's a societal question. You can't glean anything from the Constitution. You can't backfill that into the Constitution. So the state legislatures get to decide that. But that's what they did in Roe. So Congress, what they could do is, you can't undo the original plaintiffs, or in Obergefell, the original plaintiffs, but you could just say they have no power to adjudicate cases. So then states could do what they want, and these stupid third-party legal agitators can't take them to court, or if they do, they don't have standing, and it doesn't go anywhere. And that's how you return the power to the states. As a compromise to that, another suggestion I offer is, even if you're going to maintain this final arbiter status over every issue, at least reform and modify the quorum, what it takes to get a binding opinion. So, for example, a lot of people throw at me, well, Daniel, we're not a democracy, majoritarian rule. We're a republic, so it's good that you have Congress, but then the courts get to kind of overrule that. Now, that's brain dead for a number of reasons,
they're not applying that to the Supreme Court, because in that case it's a democracy that the majority rules.
Exactly.
It's not good for me, but it's okay for them. I don't like that.
You know more than any of these lawyers. I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. These guys look like I'm from Mars when I say this stuff. But you're absolutely right. The courts, first of all, what it means that we're a republic is that there is no morality in a legislature acting like a pure democracy. And, for example, Obamacare, mandating that you have to purchase a private property. There's a regulation on inactivity, right? That is manifestly against everything, the enumerated powers. So it doesn't mean, oh, the courts, we rely on the courts. It means, our republic means that it doesn't have legitimacy. And the people, ultimately, the final arbiter is not the courts, it's the people. The people have to rise up. It's the three branches. It's the federalism divided with the states, you know, to a bicameral legislature where, you know, in one of them, the small states have the same power. That's what a republic means. It means a lot of different things. It doesn't mean, oh, the courts are the final arbiter, because like you said, that's even worse. Because think about it. Okay, Senate votes 51-49 to do something, and people question the constitutionality. Man, that's majoritarian rule. We're not a democracy. We're a republic. Okay, so now you go to the Supreme Court. 5-4. Now, the four dissenters believe the five people are from Mars.
Right.
They 100% believe they are completely off base. So you have the same manifestation of the partisan divide on the elected branch, on the unelected branch, except it's worse because they're unelected and you can't get rid of them in elections. So what I'm, and I know I'm kind of, I'm getting back to the point here, what I'm suggesting as a remedy is, at least if you're going to agree to such a power, make it that it has to be unanimous. Make it that it has to be 7-2. Make it that it has to be maybe unanimous in the circuit court in order for it to be binding to throw out the law, overturn the legislature. And then if you appeal it, it has to be 7-2 in order to, you know, to overturn the law. That way, at least you could say, you know, we have a legislative body and we have the judicial branch speaking in one voice that this is manifestly unconstitutional. But right now, it's a joke. Each guy wants to get my guy who wants that political outcome on the court. So don't tell me it's, oh, this is the law, the unassailable judges. That give me a break. They're legislatures that are just unelected.
Oh, geez. Daniel, we're just about out of time. I think we can go on for another 5 hours at least. I have a million questions, but we've taken too much of your time as it is. I want to thank you so much for being our guest. You are an incredible guest, and I do hope that you will accept our invitation to return at a later date. We can continue this conversation and also give us an update on how things are going.
I had so much fun, and I'm telling you, you don't need a law degree to do this. And just remember, please order it. Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America, available at your bookstores and Amazon. You'll just learn so much. We are not following our very own system of governance we adopted. Until we get back to that, the political issues are moot.